Fearscape Media Network, exploring the unknown, one podcast at a time. Coming to you from nowhere, a suburb of parts unknown. Join Stefan and Lance, the Misters of the Dark, as they review all things horror with their latest victim. I mean guest. New episodes of Misters of the Dark drop Mondays on the Fearscape Media Network.
Welcome, everyone, to Unsensitive, a show where we take a subject, talk with an expert, and break it down with questions that are normally too impolite to ask. I'm your host, Ray Robinson, and this is actually a special edition because it's not our normal time slot. But one of the big subjects these days has been the First Amendment. It's one of the most critical and often misunderstood amendments of the U.S. Constitution, and it's been kicked to the forefront lately because of recent events, primarily regarding freedom of speech. The president has been a lightning rod for discussion on this topic, from incitement of insurrection charge that's led to his second impeachment, to the whole social media sites being abandoned for their hosting sites harboring, being upset that they're harboring hate speech. But what kind of information out there is actually truly accurate? And what is just presumed to be true by armchair lawyers? Well, here to shed some light on this subject is law professor and freedom of expression scholar, Dr. Joanne Sweeney. Joanne, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ray. Thank you. I'm excited.
Now, let's kind of launch into this a little bit with really, the first question that really has come to everybody's mind lately is, can a social media platform like Twitter, Facebook, heck, even Parler, can they deny your right to free speech by removing you from their platform?
So that's a really interesting question, because the answer is no, they cannot, because it has nothing to do with freedom of expression. When a private social media platform does anything with regard to speech, the freedom of expression, the First Amendment, and all the constitutional amendments in the federal constitution apply only to the government. It is only the government that can be sued under the First Amendment. And there are, you know, state governments, there are ways to get at state governments too, but it's basically the government. So something like Twitter or Parler or Facebook or anything like that, these are private companies and they can literally do anything they want. They can kick off any person they want off their platform for any reason whatsoever, as long as it doesn't violate, for example, like Title VII or something like that. But, you know, if it's just because they don't like what you're saying and not because, you know, they're being racist, then it's fine. Yeah, the First Amendment doesn't come into it at all. So they literally can't violate your freedom of expression because they're not governed by the First Amendment.
Okay. If by chance the government actually created a social media platform, would it apply, or would they have to put in their terms of service tough?
So if the government had like a social, if they created, which I could only assume be an extremely lame version of a social media platform.
It would indeed, but like, going completely hypothetically and pretending that, I don't know, people actually want the social media version of C-SPAN, I guess.
yeah, if the government did it, then yes, absolutely, it would be governed by the First Amendment. And that's where you see it come in with like schools and things like that, is because they're state-run, government-run entities. So then it starts applying if the government is running something. But something like Twitter, yeah, they can kick off whoever they want.
Okay. Now, speaking of the social media platforms out there, do they have any kind of responsibility to monitor and address what their audience presents on their platform? Do they have a responsibility to address things like lies, rumors, even conspiracy theories?
So that what you're talking about now is something that's addressed by the Digital Communications Act, Section 230 of the Digital Communications Act, which basically says that that social media or like any website or whatever that hosts content that is not created by them, they are immune from lawsuit. So no, they have no responsibility. And that's one of the things they're trying to get rid of, by the way. That was like one of the things that Trump was all mad about, because he's trying to get at these platforms. So, you know, there, anything that Twitter or Facebook does, at least the way the law is right now, if they create terms of service, so they start kicking people off for like Twitter and Facebook, we're putting things on like, people dispute this fact that you're saying. That's entirely on them. They're just doing it because they're realizing that, you know, people are getting angry and it might affect their market share. There isn't actually a law that's requiring them to do this at this point. Okay. And there's been a lot of controversy about this. For example, the Backpage got into, was constantly being sued because they were basically being used for human trafficking, but you know, they kept losing, you know, Backpage was continually winning lawsuits for the most part, because they are immune from lawsuit from this Digital Communications Act, which was passed, I think, in like 2002 or 2003 before we even really knew what the internet could do, but it hasn't been updated or changed.
Now, moving a little bit past social media and going more into some of recent events in regards to the president, his most recent impeachment, I have to say his most recent impeachment.
God.
The second impeachment here that he was impeached for incitement of insurrection. And is this something that the president would have been covered by with freedom of speech, or is the president he seems to want to believe that he's immune to many of the laws on the books, but is the president immune to something that's regarding freedom of speech?
Okay. So that you've got a, that's a very much a compound question. So okay. I'll get on to, so incitement by, according to the Supreme Court, is not covered by the First Amendment and is not protected speech. So if something is incitement, is by definition not protected by the First Amendment. The question then becomes, is what he said incitement? Mm-hmm. Is it incitement? Because if it is, then it's not protected by the First Amendment. And then the other question of, is he immune? Then we start getting into presidential immunity. And that's where the impeachment comes in. Because once he gets impeached and then convicted, remember, impeachment is a two-part process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most people didn't know that because you didn't have to know that. But now all of a sudden, we all need to be well aware of all these very, very obscure in a lot of cases. Like a lot of things in the last 4 years, I have had to learn more about the Constitution than I was ever taught in law school. I did not know there was an insurrection clause in the 14th Amendment. Like, what? We don't learn that. What's the Emoluments Clause? No one ever taught me that. So, you know, it's all, we're all learning new things. But the immunity, comes in when he's still president. If he gets impeached, so he's been impeached now twice by the House of Representatives, but in order to be actually kicked out, he has to be convicted by the Senate, and that is still up for grabs, and McConnell is the House Speaker for a short time longer, is delaying the vote on that, so I don't know if he'll be convicted. If he's not convicted, then he still has immunity while he's in office. Once he's not in office anymore, then everything starts, you know, then you can start sharpening your knives again, because he's no longer protected, he's not in office anymore. So the question is, you know, what does the privilege cover? And it's basically everything. That's why he has to get, I mean, arguably, this is the thing, we don't know. Mm-hmm. We don't know because this stuff is so weird and rare. And like, you know, so much of what's happened in the last 4 years is, you know, people ask me like, can they do that? I'm like, I don't know. No one's ever tried. It's crazy what's been happening. So, you know, the incitement thing, if he gets impeached and convicted, then he's not protected by any kind of immunity or presidential privilege. And then the question is even as a private citizen, he cannot be prosecuted for a crime if he's protected by the First Amendment, right? Because it's the government that we're putting you in jail. So mm-hmm. Now the First Amendment applies. So even if he doesn't have presidential privilege, if he's protected by the First Amendment, then he's fine. So question is it incitement? And it's questionable to me, even, you know, everything that happened, it's a difficult case, to be honest. If you think about the case where he, we had a case, which Dan Cannon, sued him over, which was the Louisville rally that he had back when he was still a candidate, and there were protesters there, and he said, get him out of here. And then the crowd, you know, beat them up. And so Dan sued him for incitement, so he wouldn't have First Amendment protection. And despite everything and all the context and all the news, you know, the press conferences and the other statements he made, the Sixth Circuit, the federal court held ultimately that he was protected by the First Amendment and that was not incitement. So considering everything in context, I don't know if it's incitement, I'll be honest. He didn't say, I command you to go, you know, break into the Capitol and destroy property. So it's more indirect than that. He said, we're going to march on Washington together. Is that enough? He says, you have to fight for it. He could argue speaking figuratively, because he also said, you know, we need to talk to our representatives. So I think he is pretty good at walking this line where he can cover himself and saying, look, I was speaking metaphorically. I didn't actually intend for them to do that. And for intent, you need, you know, for incitement, you need intent. Mm-hmm. So I think it'd be a difficult case. Giuliani is a much easier case when he's demanding trial by combat. Don Jr. saying, you know, we need to fight. An easier case than if, and the question is, can we take all of these speakers that happened on the same day on January 6th and we can put them all together and then create this one kind of incitement stew? I don't know if we can do that. No one's ever done that before. So,
well, speaking of which, kind of going just on your personal opinion, yeah. Is it good that we're pushing these boundaries so we can find out what they are? I mean, you may or may not be a fan of the boundaries that are being pushed necessarily, but from a legal point of view, is it a good thing to just test these and see how far they push?
So you mean by an incitement?
Yes.
So I think he should have been, I think what he did before was incitement. So, you know, I actually would love him to go to jail for, you know, pick a reason. You know, there's so many reasons that I would like him to go to jail forever. And let's just get his whole family. That'd be amazing to me. You know, I am very much my own philosophy, a very much a utilitarian, mm-hmm. in that I'm always looking at who is being harmed. And I think that the Sixth Circuit absolutely got it wrong. I've written things to that extent. I wrote something for Salon back when the case happened. I've written law review articles that I think that one. And I also looked at the Charlottesville rally, and there's still a lawsuit about whether that was incitement. The organizers of the rally. I think that you should look context of the speech. I think you should be looking at whether the audience of the speaker would interpret what they're saying as a coded message. Whether, you know, you can look at dog whistles, you can look, you know, I think that those things should be taken into account. And the Sixth Circuit in that earlier case refused to do so, which I think was a mistake. I think he did push it too far. I think he's been doing so for years. And this was anyone who's surprised by what happened on January 6th has not been paying attention. We all suspected that this could happen. He's been riling these people up for ages. He gets them to chant and like pledge, and like the cult-like status of this man, and the way he is able to get people to do his bidding and believe ridiculous lies. There was always danger, and he was stoking it for a really long time. So should he be held responsible for that? I think so. Yes. I hope that he does, you know, I hope this does go somewhere. And I hope that the result is different than it was in the past. That they, you know, finally are, that the courts finally realize that this speech that he does, that, yeah, if you just read the words themselves, it's not giving you the full picture. And you really should take the context of it.
Excellent. Now let's kind of pivot a little bit more into a different area, but keeping with free speech, there has been a long held belief that school campuses, and you touched on this briefly earlier, school campuses are bastions of freedom of speech. Is this an accurate statement or not?
Do you mean like universities?
Universities or... primarily.
Oh yeah. No.
No. Okay.
I mean, it just depends, I suppose. I think that it's a tough one, because again, a lot of universities are public and government run, and therefore, you know, there are First Amendment issues. A lot of schools have, at least in the past, have had, you know, hate speech you know, rules, and those have been gone under fire under First Amendment that, you know, you can't tell me what I can or can't say. There have been recent, you know, schools canceling speakers that they're worried for security concerns, and there's been lawsuits about that. There's also been cases where, you know, students who say things on social media have been disciplined. So, you know, schools generally are treated a lot more deferentially than other entities when they are governing their students. And this is particularly true of like elementary, high school, but even universities are given a lot of deference. So it really, they're given a lot of leeway on how they want their policies to be. So it really just depends on the school and what their policies are. So I don't think it's consistent, and I don't think it's fair to say that schools are this bastion of free speech, because it's not consistent, and they have a lot of leeway about how they can regulate the speech of their students. Especially a lot, and especially another thing is because, you know, if you look at, you know, the punishment that schools can dole out to their students, any kind of like suspension or expelled or whatever, that's not the same as like putting someone in jail. So yeah. There's, you know, a lot of leeway in that respect too, that that they are given the discretion to govern, you know, their own student bodies in a way.
Now, a term that's really come to light over the last few years here is the term cancel culture. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of concern that sometimes the cancel culture environment it goes too far. Is this really a new problem that's just blossomed because of social media, or is this something that's kind of been in our culture for a long time, just under a different form?
What, like the angry mob?
The angry mob, yep, pitchforks and all.
Sure. So the difference now is how quickly things can spread. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is a big difference. So if you say something that people take offense to, they can, not only can they spread it very quickly, and the criticisms can snowball, but they also, people are very willing to look you up, call your boss, do whatever, you know, to try to get you in trouble. So, I mean, I have an issue with this idea of this phrase, cancel culture, mm-hmm. because I think a lot of times it's used by, you know, the right to say like, oh, it's cancel culture, you're just trying to silence me. And it's like, no, people don't like what you're saying. And when it's something like racism or misogyny or someone, you know, threatening somebody, I don't mind that there are social or professional consequences. Because a lot of times that's all we have. You know, so if legally we can't do anything to you, then yeah, you get fired. And that's what you get for being a racist asshole on social media, is that people get to tell your boss and you get fired. If you look, what's really interesting, because a lot of this stuff comes up, this cancel culture or something going too far, that's come up a lot with like the Me Too movement, that, you know, you're basically, there's no due process. All of a sudden people are like super concerned about due process when suddenly that, you know, in the past they weren't. You know, you got Trump talking about due process with Title IX. So like sexual assault, you know, complaints on college campuses. And he's the guy that took out a full page ad in the New York Times trying to get these kids put in jail, like the Central Park Six. So like, forget, like he has no standing to talk about this at all, no credibility. But right now what's happening is, you know, look at all the people that are going on social media and finding all these people that like stormed the Capitol, and no one's saying due process for them. Mm-hmm. So like, okay, so that's okay for you. That's not cancel culture because reasons. But when it's done, you know, for someone saying something, you know, offensive or harassing somebody for, you know, race or gender, suddenly it's cancel culture because I'm just speaking my mind. It's like, yeah, you spoke your mind sucks. So I don't like the phrase cancel culture. Do I think that people can take it too far and go on a witch hunt and take things out of context? And yeah, I think it can happen. Sure. But considering that, you know, what is the alternative? Is that we just let people say horrific stuff and like harass people and there are no consequences? I don't like that either. So, you know.
Yeah. Now, we kind of circled back to Trump again, which is good because really that kind of leads into my final big question, really. And that's a lot of folks have said that due to the last 4 years of having Donald Trump as president, we now live in a post-truth society where all you got to do is point at something, call it fake news, and it's no longer valid anymore. Is this really... Would you say that that's true about where we are right now as a society? Are we in a post-truth world?
I mean, I don't know if that's post-truth. I mean, that makes it seem so final. I'd like to think that this is just a temporary bout of insanity led by an autocratic fascist dictator. And he was using the playbook that all fascist dictators use. And now we were able to get past him, elect somebody who's not a fascist dictator for whatever his faults are, and he has them, that maybe we can pull it back. But yeah, he was absolutely using the playbook that you can't trust. You can't trust the media. He, would lie all the time. People believe the lies. This whole thing about, the election being stolen is garbage and there's no facts. And I get into Facebook fights, even though I know I shouldn't. Because there's no point, but I do it anyway sometimes. But it's just, there's all this evidence. There's 1,000 affidavits showing there's been election fraud. I'm like, then why did he lose all his cases if this evidence actually exists? So I'd like to believe that we can come back from it. I'd like to believe that we can restore credibility or at least restore the perception of credibility. People are sore losers. And they, these are the same people. They're like, you lost, get over it. And then they're like, meh, it was stolen election. Same people. A lot of it to me is based, it comes from people. There's something very comforting in fascism, clearly. And that's why people gravitate toward it. It's really nice to have someone be like, don't worry about all that stuff. Just do this one thing and you'll be fine. You're like, oh, cool. I don't have to think for myself. Awesome. Life's complicated. You just do the thinking for me. I see the appeal, I guess. So, but if someone tells you, I'm the one that's going to take care of you. Everyone who says otherwise is lying to you. It's just easier to just not have to worry about thinking for yourself. So I hope that we get past that. I hope we grow up a bit. Part of it is, I do think that we have gone away from critical thinking and education, that by defunding education and not, focusing on that stuff, that we have lost that. But at the same time, a lot of the people buying into his crap are people that were educated back when education was funded. So I don't know. I think that, when I'm arguing with people and I'm like, look, if you look at Snopes, they're like, well, Snopes is a liberal bias. I'm like, well, I have nothing to say then. If you literally don't believe the sites that exist just to fact check, then we can't have a conversation. There's nothing I can say that will convince you. That's why I called it a cult earlier. It's basically like a faith-based organization. I just have faith. I don't have evidence. I just believe it, which I think is very dangerous. Mm-hmm. And if we get back to, getting back to the idea of the First Amendment, we have this, we protect the First Amendment so strongly in this country, particularly compared to other countries. And one of the main reasons is this ideal that we have, that kind of the basis for it is this concept of the marketplace of ideas, right? That's one of the underpinnings of the First Amendment, that we need to have as much speech as possible so that the truth will come out, right? That if everyone gets to say what they think, you can basically shop around and buy the thing that actually makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. And you'll figure it out because you're getting information. So in our country, we think that the only cure for bad speech, lies, defamation, whatever, is more speech. We don't think you should censor or silence. And there's a lot of really good reasons why we think that. And one of the main ones, and I think a lot of people don't realize how much of our First Amendment doctrine came about because of the civil rights movements. So what was happening back in the 1960s is that the government was using defamation or incitement to try to silence civil rights leaders. So one of the things they tried to do was that any kind of newspaper that reported on these protests civil rights protests, they would sue the newspaper if they got even one little fact wrong. They would sue them for defamation. They said, this is false. Even if they're like, there were 12 people there, like, well, there were 15. So something that minor. And that's why we've had an evolved freedom of expression doctrine around incitement, around defamation and things like that, is because the government was trying to silence speech, and by doing so oppress Black people. And so that's one of the reasons why we're like, we don't want to silence people, because we were wrong before. And by judging, we don't want to judge speech as being good or bad, because we really screwed it up before, and we don't trust our even the judges, because they got it wrong a lot too. We don't want to do that anymore. So we're just going to let as much speech in as possible and let people sort it out. But when you get into, you know, the modern age now, when you get into these like echo chambers where people are purposefully silencing people who disagree with them, and this is done, you know, people kind of do it informally by like blocking people that are, you know, they don't like. But they like, if you look at, if you think about Parler, and a lot of these other sites, they deliberately kick people out that don't believe the same things they do. And so good speech can't correct the bad speech, because it's not being let in. So that would be a huge step, I think, into kind of fixing a lot of what's gone wrong in this post-truth society, is to try to start removing some of these echo chambers. And a big part of it is the media. And I think having a president who respects the media and, you know, gives them space and doesn't continually, every time there's a bad story about him, say they're lying. I do think that, I'm hoping that over time it'll start to get healed and mended a bit, but I honestly don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if it's fixable, which is a very, you know, depressing thought.
Yeah, but it is a valid one. It's a valid concern that folks have. So mm-hmm. That makes sense to me. So Joanne, I've got to tell you, this interview been fire. it's just as I was expecting and hoping, full of passion and wonderful information. So tell everybody that's listening where they can find out more about some of your writing and some of your thoughts.
Sure. So, I mean, I publish law review articles, which are really long and not interesting. So I'm not going to suggest those. I have an SSRN page if you really want to read the long stuff. I've actually written a bit on incitement and things like that. I have a column, at least I had one in the past in Salon, but now my most recent stuff, me and Dan Cannon, who was that lawyer I was mentioning before, we have started a Medium page called I Taught the Law. We're so clever. So it's medium.com/I Taught the Law. And we publish, we edit articles, but we write our own things too. And it's on a wide variety of subjects. We've certainly been writing quite a bit about what's been going on. I actually have an article called What the Fuck is Sedition? So if you want to learn a bit about that, if you wanted to know what's the difference between sedition and treason, I tell you, and this is a good publication for non-lawyers. It's geared towards non-lawyers. So we explain things for normal people, not people that are steeped in legal terminology like we are.
So when people are doing their armchair lawyer bit on Facebook, they can quote you.
I wish they would. I wish they would, because a lot of people say a lot of stuff, a bunch of constitutional law scholars filling up my Facebook. And I'm like, okay, I guess you'd know.
Well, Joanne, once again, thank you so much. It's been entertaining as well as very informative. So thank you for sharing your time and your knowledge with everybody listening.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, Ray. It's fun to talk about this stuff.
Absolutely. And now, as always, a challenge to the folks that are listening. If you also have a subject that you're passionate about, like Joanne here, you can speak with authority on it, and we want to tackle some of those tough questions, then I want to talk to you here on Unsensitive. So reach out to me through the Fearscape Media Network, or write me directly at rayrobwrites@gmail.com, and maybe you'll be the next one on the show. A special thanks to Ben Sounds for the use of the song Happy Rock, and of course the fine folks at Fearscape for giving me a platform once again. Thank you for listening to Unsensitive. We'll talk again soon, and until then, keep your mind open.